My name is Lauren Reese, and I direct the Environmental Change and Security Program. Thank you all for being on the call today. Together with my colleagues in the China Environment Forum and Science and Technology Innovation Program, we're so pleased to bring you a top-notch lineup of speakers. You know, a former colleague at the Wilson Center once told me that after sitting through 15 years worth of Wilson Center panels, the first event she attended still stood out as the one that frightened her most. It was on the potential impact of a global pandemic, not unlike what we're experiencing today. As shocking as the COVID-19 headlines have been and continue to be, as Jane said, there are experts who have been for many years trying to sound the alarm. And in fact, there have been clear signals of the risks posed by animal-to-human virus transmission. Ebola, H1N1, SARS, MERS, and even HIV all originated in animals. So that begs the question, now that the alarm has sounded so loudly it can't be ignored, what are the underlying drivers of risk that created the conditions for COVID-19 to emerge, and how do we better address them? One thing that I think will come out in the next hour is that when we talk about drivers of risk, we're not just talking about wet markets, our increasingly connected world, or even public health. Before the coronavirus, climate change was already beginning to change the ways we live, work, and think about our future. New fields of study like planetary health and approaches like One Health have developed to better understand and address the connections between ecosystem and human health. The program that I direct has its roots in environmental security, which recognizes the role that the environment and natural resources can play in exacerbating conflict or facilitating peace. So how do we take the lessons from these fields and others and better institutionalize them in our governing structures to help drive anticipatory decision-making that at a minimum helps us better prepare for the next crisis? So first, we're going to hear from Sharon. Sharon Gynup is a journalist and author, a National Geographic Explorer, and a Wilson Center Global Fellow. She's written for the New York Times, the Washington Post, National Geographic, Scientific American, and Smithsonian, as well as our own New Security Beat, covering wildlife, ecosystems, energy, and climate change. For the last several years, much of her work has delved into poaching and wildlife crime. And if you've been following any of the press around Tiger King, you've no doubt seen her name, and I urge you to read her December 2019 National Geographic article on captive tigers in the U.S. Sharon, over to you.
Thank you, Lauren, for the kind introduction, and I, too, would like to thank you all for joining us today. I'm calling in from the New York metropolitan area, which is the nation's COVID-19 epicenter. You may hear ambulances screaming by during today's call, headed for the hospital down the street. It's my constant reminder of the local, national, and global battle we're fighting against this virus. My colleagues will detail information about this coronavirus and other zoonotic diseases, the diseases that jump between animals and humans, but I would like to provide an overview for this issue. The current pandemic has brought our relationship with wildlife and nature into sharp focus, and along with it, the renewed realization that human health relies on the health of the planet. An estimated 70% of new human infectious disease outbreaks come from pathogens that originated in animals. Increasingly, diseases are moving between people, livestock, and wildlife, creating concerns about food safety, wildlife conservation, and especially now, public health. As Lauren mentioned, these include HIV/AIDS, Ebola, swine flu, avian flu, and two other coronaviruses, SARS and MERS. Since the mid-20th century, new and deadly diseases have emerged at an alarming rate, with more than 335 emerging infectious disease outbreaks reported worldwide. Because this new coronavirus may have originated in a seafood and wildlife market in Wuhan, China, it has centered particular attention on the trade and consumption of wild species. For decades, we have heard dire warnings from epidemiologists and infectious disease experts that markets like the one in Wuhan are dangerous breeding grounds for the next pandemic. These markets are microbial petri dishes. Wild animals are shipped from around the world and then jammed together in filthy, cramped cages. Bats, chickens, civet cats, birds, pangolins, and a host of other species. Many are weakened or sick from traumatic capture and transport. Some markets butcher them on site. And in such close proximity, these animals exchange pathogens that can evolve, gaining the ability to jump into new vulnerable hosts that lack natural immunity to them, and that includes humans. Nearly all zoonotic diseases originate in either mammal or bird hosts. It's important to note that these markets are not unique to China. They're found across Asia, Africa, and Latin America. Wildlife is bought and sold in every country on Earth. It's consumed as wild meat, ingredients in traditional medicines, and bought as pets and other products. China is the largest consumer, but few people realize that the United States ranks second, although the volume is far less and the uses are quite different. Illegal wildlife trade generates up to $23 billion a year, excluding illegal fishing, and now ranks, as the world's fourth largest source of criminal earnings. The perpetrators are transnational crime syndicates and military groups, which has elevated this trade to a national security issue. Global trends indicate that new microbial threats will continue to emerge at an unprecedented, accelerating rate. And while wildlife trade is a significant factor, it's not the only one. With 7.7 billion people on the planet, we are intruding ever further into the world's last wild places. The science is clear that the loss and fragmentation of wildlife habitat is a major factor in the spread of zoonotic disease, bringing humans, their livestock, pets, and urban populations in closer contact with wild animals and with the viruses they carry. And COVID-19 illustrates how quickly an outbreak can spread via international travel and trade. Overall, global COVID-19 infections continue to rise along with the death toll. There are also very serious economic impacts. In April, the International Monetary Fund's World Economic Outlook concluded that the global economy would experience, quote, its worst recession since the Great Depression, unquote, surpassing that seen during the global financial crisis a decade ago. But there are many unknowns. A lot depends on the epidemiology of the virus, the effectiveness of shelter-at-home measures, the development of effective treatments, and whether a vaccine can be produced that will provide immunity. The ultimate human and economic toll cannot be predicted. Given the deep interconnectedness of our world, this coronavirus will not be the last outbreak, and we now have a choice. We can recognize that we are vulnerable to emerging viral threats, or we can choose to ignore recommendations for decision-making and investments that will prevent or help us to respond to new threats. The pandemic has led to renewed calls from the global community for an outright ban on the consumption of wild animals. It has also placed China's wildlife trade policies under intense international scrutiny. The Chinese government shut down its wildlife markets in 2002 during the SARS epidemic. However, the markets reopened when the crisis passed. This past February, in response to COVID-19, the National People's Congress of China closed wildlife markets, passed a ban on consumption of terrestrial wildlife as food, and clamped down on trade. But since then, Chinese lawmakers and academics have begun campaigning to exclude 54 wild species that are farmed for human consumption in captive breeding facilities, including tigers, bears, bushmeat species such as civets, bamboo rats, and many others. Civets are thought to have been a host species for SARS. Experts note that it is crucial that China uphold current bans and extend them to include traditional medicine and ornamental items. Any wild species may carry bad actor pathogens, whether they're legally traded or sold on the black market. China's actions will have an enormous ripple effect on the policies of neighboring countries that are both consumers and active trade hubs, including Vietnam and Thailand. However, since wildlife trade is a global issue, it requires a global effort. Countries must develop and adopt multi-pronged approaches that include strengthening policy and enforcement at national levels, raising public awareness, promoting community involvement, and changing consumer behavior. The illegal trade has gained increasing attention from key UN agencies and international enforcement entities, including Interpol. An effective fight against wildlife trafficking will require their continued commitment. It's also been suggested that the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, or CITES, be amended to incorporate health risks. The CITES Treaty, with 183 signatories, regulates trade in wildlife and plants according to conservation status, but it does not address enforcement. There is currently no global legal agreement on wildlife crime, leaving a need for enforcement to be embedded within international frameworks. We will also need a much deeper knowledge of the threats. Experts say that this will, in turn, help us better predict, prevent, and respond to future outbreaks and save countless lives. It will cost billions of dollars. One proposed scientific collaboration is the Global Virome Project. It would, within a decade, identify and provide detailed knowledge of the viruses that could cause the next outbreak. Researchers estimate that mammals and birds may carry 1.6 million viruses, and some 700,000 could present a risk to human health. Another initiative, the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations, has already raised hundreds of millions of dollars to develop vaccine pipelines for emerging infectious diseases. In the last weeks, the U.S. made an important step by dramatically increasing funding to the U.S. Agency for International Development's Global Health Bureau. This may revive USAID's defunct PREDICT program that had been established to identify and combat viruses that could generate global public health emergencies. Our well-being is inextricably linked with that of the planet's web of life. In fact, one could argue that the state of the world can be measured by the state of the wild. Perhaps this current pandemic will serve as a clarion call that we are vulnerable to emerging viral threats. Human health, animal health, and ecosystem health are inextricably linked, and protecting nature protects humanity. Ecosystems act as huge carbon vaults, mitigate extreme weather, and provide buffers from flooding. They provide wood, nurture pollinators, and provide wood. They clean the air and purify drinking water for billions of people. And keeping them intact could prevent the next pandemic, which is just a plane flight away. Thank you.
Thank you, Sharon. Next, we're going to hear from Dr. Ellen Carlin. Dr. Carlin is a veterinarian with expertise on zoonoses, emerging infectious disease epidemiology and policy, and U.S. biodefense policy. She is an assistant research professor in the Department of Microbiology and Immunology in Georgetown University's Center for Global Health and Security and director of the graduate program in global infectious disease. Up until a few months ago, Dr. Carlin served as senior health and policy specialist at EcoHealth Alliance. She also has extensive experience on the Hill, where she was senior professional staff with the House of Representatives Committee on Homeland Security. Ellen, over to you.
Lauren, thank you so much for that introduction, and thank you so much for convening this really important discussion today. So I guess I wanted to start by mentioning the victims of COVID-19. I think it's a good way to put what we're talking about in context. There are, of course, the human victims, those who are infected globally. According to the Johns Hopkins tracker, which I'm looking at right now, it's 2.4 million confirmed cases, with the U.S. leading at 759,000. So these are all of the people infected are victims, and their families and their friends and the businesses that rely on them to operate are victims. And there are also the animal victims. You know, there are, Sharon gave a really nice introduction to the wildlife trade. And there's an awful lot of discussion about wildlife trade bans. And we can maybe talk about that during the Q&A, where I think we'll get into some of the policy implications of what's been going on. But I think that it's easy to think that wildlife will benefit if trade bans go into effect. But, you know, these wet markets are actually likely to go underground if they are banned, and animal welfare could get even worse. We also know that poaching is increasing in some countries, such as in Africa, as tourism revenue declines and local people need money to support their livelihoods, and there's less money for security for these animals. And last but not least, bats largely get demonized in this discussion, and there's really nothing negative that I can possibly say about bats. They are such important providers of ecosystem services, and they are the largest mammalian group on the planet. There's also a lot of confusion and misinformation about where COVID-19 came from. Many comments to me are about how, boy, people really need to stop eating bats, huh? So we don't know that this happened because someone ate a bat. In fact, I wouldn't think that was likely. We don't even know that it came from the Wuhan market that's been in the news for several months now as the likely source. It is certainly very likely that this virus moved from its origins in a bat, perhaps through an intermediary animal, which may have been consumed for food or may have been handled or may have been used medicinally. That is a possible route of transmission. There's also a story circulating now that this could have resulted from an accidental release from a laboratory, a major virology laboratory in Wuhan, which was studying coronaviruses from bats. And laboratory accidents are certainly among the triad of potential origins that we think about as being the source of any outbreak, that being nature, human beings through terrorism or biocrimes, and laboratories. I think what I want to spend the next few minutes remarking on is that COVID-19 is much bigger than the problems with wildlife trade. I think wildlife trade is a piece of what we are reckoning with right now. COVID-19 is really giving us a chance to finally reckon in a really public way with the many drivers that are pushing infections out of the forest, out of animal hosts, out of insect vectors, and into other animals or people that haven't previously been exposed to them. I'm getting a bit of feedback.
Somebody seems to be off mute. If you could off mute your lines, thank you so much. Go ahead, Ellen.
Sure. So just talking about the drivers, I think, you know, we need to be very, very clear that this is a human-made problem, a humanity-made problem. This is not a China-made problem. It's not a bat-made problem. It's really all of us collectively making decisions about the way that we live. It's not just about consumption of wildlife, although bushmeat is certainly a risk factor. But the acceleration of the emergence of infectious diseases in the last several decades has everything to do with human behavior. We are constantly increasing the human interface with nature as we push into forests that once separated us from the animals that live in them. We're talking about land use change on massive scales, mass urbanization and demographic shifts, agricultural intensification, climate change, disruption of ecological systems on tremendous scale, areas like the extractive industry, the growth in palm oil plantations, the development of bigger and bigger cities, the development of suburbs. These are the ways in which the growing global desire for certain commodities and to live a certain way puts pressure on ecosystems and creates really unnatural interfaces. And we can see it here at home. You know, we don't even really think very much about Lyme disease as an emerging infectious disease anymore, but it was once, not that long ago. 30,000 cases of Lyme are reported in the U.S. every year. That was a pathogen that, as far as we know, had kept itself to forests until well-meaning suburban developments created this lush interface of grasses at the forest edge, which attract deer and put them in very close proximity to people, which hadn't been the case before. So you set up a risk factor for Lyme in that way. You know, similarly, wet markets aren't new. They've been around a very long time. But the human desire for a globalized world means we've created dense factory cities. Wuhan, like many cities in China, supply the commodities that we Americans and many others are looking for. So you set up these dense cities, physical pathways through which viruses can travel out of these traditional markets, which have been around for centuries and around the globe in 24 hours. So understanding the drivers and the risk pathways is really important. If you take a shot at the drivers, you get a shot at prevention. We're hearing a lot about the lack of intelligence awareness that went into this epidemic and pandemic, our lack of preparedness for it. And those are both critical, but we're hearing very little about prevention, really outside of the commentators who talk about shutting down wet markets. This is way bigger than wet markets, and complex problems demand complex solutions. So all of this could be mitigated if we extracted less, clear-cut less, traveled less. Then you'd have, you know, an outbreak that might happen in one place, but it would stay there. I don't think it's realistic to think that everyone just stops traveling. That cat has been out of the bag for about 500 years. But there may be other things that we can do to start changing our habits and the habits of people in other countries as well. And I'll leave with some thoughts about why these dynamics make emerging infectious disease a public health security issue, and indeed a national security issue. You have localized epidemics that can rapidly translate into globalized pandemics. This one is causing massive economic upset in line with the Great Depression, and it's completely upended our ability to deal with other health threats that are still occurring. All of the other health problems that we have haven't gone away. It's also made us unbelievably vulnerable to an intentional act that could be perpetrated at the same time. I am very worried that the depletion of supplies and other resources could put us at significant vulnerability if someone deliberately wanted to hurt us right now. So I'll kind of close with the idea that the securitization of public health, to my mind, really started after the anthrax attacks of 2001. And after a few years of enthusiasm, it became hard to maintain that traction once the sense of the immediate threat was gone. Hopefully we understand that threat is immediate and still here. Emerging infectious diseases are here, and they are here to stay, as long as the drivers are here. And hopefully we can get some traction now, really thinking about emerging infectious diseases being adequately integrated into the national security construct. That's it for me. Over.
Thank you, Ellen. Next, we'll hear from Dr. Rod Schoonover, who is founder and principal of Ecological Futures Group and adjunct professor at Georgetown University. He spent a decade in senior roles in the U.S. intelligence community, both at the National Intelligence Council and the State Department. Dr. Schoonover is widely recognized for helping to elevate and establish ecological and environmental issues within the national security framework of the United States. Rod, real quick, before we get to you, let me do a quick reminder that if you are listening and would like to get in queue to ask a question, please press star 1 on your phone, and we'll get to the Q&A after Dr. Schoonover. Over to you, Rod.
Great. Can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear.
Wonderful. Thank you. Thank you, Lauren, and thanks to the Wilson Center for having me on today. This is a critically important discussion to have right now, and I'm thrilled to be a part of it. The comments from Sharon and Ellen already have been outstanding. And thanks to those who have tuned in this afternoon. So I'll just say my comments today come primarily from a national security perspective. The United States has a massive national security apparatus, by far the largest in the world, with a gigantic budget. And the Department of Defense budget is in the ballpark of $700 billion annually. And there are the comparatively smaller but sizable budgets of the intelligence community, departments of state, energy, et cetera. But the national security budget should be large because national security is the government's most important role, especially the protection of its citizens at home and abroad. Unfortunately, U.S. national security is outdated and needs to be recalibrated, I think, to reflect the threats that the country faces. So almost 3,000 people died in the September 11 attacks, most of them Americans, which led to a huge shift, some might even say radical, in our national security institutions. And counterterrorism became a dominant focus of government, in addition to two costly wars. As of this morning, almost 36,000 people have died from COVID-19 in the United States, already more than 10 times that from 9/11, and this number will surely grow. And the accompanying economic harm will be just as dramatic. And there's also been a return in U.S. national security circles to so-called great powers conflict. While still in government under the Trump administration, I was told explicitly that there are only four countries the U.S. cares about: China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea. So as a senior intelligence officer focused on environmental and ecological change, this felt like a giant disconnect. The planet is being dramatically changed by anthropogenic forces, and dangerously so, but we continue to be stuck in old paradigms. And in 2019, there were three important international scientific assessments released that should have shaken the national security community to its core if it were paying attention. And two of these were IPCC reports. One was on the effects of climate change on the cryosphere and the ocean, and the other on land and terrestrial systems, both alarming. But most important, I think, was the global assessment report issued by the Intergovernmental Panel on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services, IPBES. This is the single most terrifying report I read while in government. And I spent a decade in the intelligence community. It outlined that biodiversity and the ecosystem services they provide are declining faster than any time in human history. The drivers of change are accelerating. Species extinctions, population declines, mass mortality events, et cetera. Now, if you think of natural and ecological systems as relevant only to pretty pictures on National Geographic or documentaries on Animal Planet, then this probably registers somewhere on the, oh, that's too bad meter. But if you understand the deep connectedness of the planet, which many of the listeners on this call undoubtedly do, you understand that the very support system for humanity is in jeopardy and pertinent to zoonotic disease. We know, for example, that high biodiversity inhibits the transmission of pathogens through a variety of mechanisms. And so my argument then is that U.S. national security needs to be updated, recalibrated, if you will. The U.S. needs to reposition global ecological disruption, and this is a term I use as shorthand for the basket of Earth system stresses that includes climate change and land and sea use change and pollution and plastics, nitrogen and phosphorus imbalance, invasive species. These are terms not normally found in typical national security discussions. These need to be rerouted as core national security concerns. Presently, these issues are, at best, add-ons to, quote-unquote, real national security concerns. And so this recalibration should be reflected not only in terms of U.S. national security strategy, but in operations and resource allocations and personnel. There's a great need to bring more climate scientists, ecologists, veterinarians, epidemiologists, and the like, not just into government, but into the national security domain. My argument here is that if a national security institution is staffed only by officers who see the world primarily through a geopolitical, geostrategic lens, they're unlikely to prioritize or even understand the dramatic changes occurring right under our feet. Now, as an officer in the intelligence community, I was asked to write on or speak to the national security implications of a variety of ecological and environmental issues, such as wildlife trafficking and biodiversity loss and illegal fishing. But because our national security doctrine is outdated, this often required me tethering these effects to terrorism, insurgency, political instability. I'm pretty skilled at doing so, And these are all important and interesting considerations, but shouldn't it have been enough to frame these risks in terms of undercutting ecosystem health, the very support system for human life, or heightening the risk of zoonotic disease? These arguments currently don't get much traction, unfortunately. So science has long been a core component of national security, so we should appropriately resource scientific institutions to tackle these emergent national security issues. And so much science needs to be filled in. So just with respect to understanding the pathogen space of the human-animal, human-wildlife agriculture interface, we know that surveillance is not enough. Simply cataloging viruses without understanding which are dangerous to humans is not enough. This kind of science needs a lot of support, needs resources. We need to better understand how environmental stress, including climate change, affects geographic ranges and migration patterns of disease hosts and vectors. For example, how do deforestation and habitat change affect the movement of rodents and bat populations? Is this quantifiable? Can we put these into a model? Well, we learned that the best national security strategy for the suppression of emergent zoonotic disease is right out of the old conservation playbook, preserve habitats. What does a climate-smart, ecologically informed pandemic preparedness policy look like from a scientific perspective? What scientific gaps are there that we need to fill in? I think these are all really important parts and questions that need to be answered, not just by the national security community, but also the scientific community. And I highly advocate for increased discussions between these groups. And in the interest of time, I'll stop there, I think, and look forward to further discussion and questions.
Thank you so much, Rod.